Hey, y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Yeah, I'm running behind, as always. That's all right. I don't care. Do you care? Today's show, Mitchell Prothro and Reese Ehrlich. And, you know, I want to... Man, I sent so many other invites out. Bandout can't do it. But it just occurred to me, you know who I need to talk to? Of course, is Eric Margulies, man. He's good on... China and Korea issues, of course. And he usually says yes if I invite him on the show. So that's pretty good, too. Moment's notice kind of thing. I've been trying to figure out who the hell to get on to talk about the protests in Hong Kong. Margulies, man. Margulies, yeah. He knows. All right, well, so I'm going to call him at the break, see if I can get him on. But Reese Ehrlich, man, he's good. You might remember, if you remember, back in 2010, and there's video of this. This is how you would probably remember it. Back in 2010, I was on a panel discussion type thing at the University of California at Riverside with Reese Ehrlich and a neocon and a student. And the student didn't really have too much to say. Reese Ehrlich had a lot of great things to say. And then the neocon was a complete kook and... Reese Ehrlich and I smashed him, and it was kind of fun. We politely smashed him. Anyway, turns out this guy, Reese Ehrlich, he's really good, man. I should read all his books and all his stuff and really keep up with him. He wrote this thing. We ran us the spotlight, I don't know, last Friday or over the weekend or something like that on antiwar.com. Oh, yeah, it would have been last Friday, I think. And it was debunking 10 myths about the newest war here. Well, I got it. 10 myths about Obama's latest war in Iraq and Syria. And, yeah, it's really good. And it's in listicle format for your digestive pleasure. 10 myths about Obama's latest war in Iraq. It's really comprehensive, though. Turns out, surprise, surprise, Reese was in Kurdistan when the war broke out. That's plenty to say. So that'll be good. But before that, we're going to have Mitchell Prothro back on the show. And I know now that I should have been calling him Mitch all the time. So that's a problem. And then yesterday, all of a sudden, now there's a question about how to say his last name because Landay said it wrong, or maybe I've been saying it wrong. So I'm going to have to figure out how to say this guy's name. You'd think that I would have just asked him in the first place. Never occurred to me that it could be Prothero, but that was what Landay said. That isn't right, right? It's Prothero. But it's really Mitch, not Mitchell. Anyway. He's a great journalist, man. He's broken a bunch of stories lately. He's covering the war. He's got this huge scoop about this French intelligence agent who switched sides over to Al-Qaeda. Confirmed by James Gordon Meek and others at ABC News yesterday. I'm not really sure how important it is in the scheme of things, but it's a big story for him, you know, to break and all that. Exclusive, so that's cool. But really what I want to ask him about is the shape of the war over there. As he sees him from Irbil. And so that'd be good. Coming up here in just a little while, Mitchell Prothro from McClatchy Newspapers. And so he's got the helicopter story. He's got the Mujahideen on the outskirts of Baghdad story. And then, of course, the fight over Kobane in Turkey. And that was, I should have focused much more on that with his colleague Landay, Jonathan Landay, on the show yesterday, and I didn't. So I'll try to focus more on that with Mitchell today. Looks like, I don't know, last I heard, Kobane was about to be completely overrun, but it wasn't completely overrun yet, but matter of time there in Syrian Kurdistan at the Turkish border, with the Turks just sitting back watching as ISIS smashes the PKK. So, there's that. So Prothro and Reese both on the show today about the new war. And news. And then I'm going to try to get Margulies on. I better write that down so I don't forget with my stupid brain. Margulies here. Going to call him in just a few minutes. See if he can do it. And then... there's this guy named MK something something. Bhadra Kumar. See, that's not that hard. You just gotta sound it out. Bhadra Kumar. M.K. Bhadra Kumar. That's how I'm gonna say it until I'm corrected. If I say his name better than Mitchell's. M.K. Bhadra Kumar. And he's an Indian former diplomat. Writes a blog at Indian Punchline, which I like that. Foreign affairs with a little bit of... I didn't see what's so funny about it. But anyway, he wrote this great piece, India Should Insulate from War on Islamic State. Hey, India, don't get caught up in this one, he says. Very interesting article, very well done. I think it's the one of the top viewpoints. Yeah, it's the top viewpoint on antiwar.com today. Not the spotlight, but under the other six. It's the first of those. And, yeah, very interesting stuff. Very good stuff. A very thorough take on the matter, but from an Indian perspective, which is something that don't often get to hear. So, there's that. All right. And, okay, I guess I can get to the bad news, man. Reports, multiple reports now, and they waited, Eric and Jason Ditz over there at antiwar.com, they waited till they had multiple reports. It is basically, the town of Hit is out in the center, or Heat, however you say it, is out in the center of Islamic State, Sunni stand there, so it's going to be hard to get real confirmation, but they did have multiple sources on 22 people killed, 22 civilians killed at a marketplace in a U.S. airstrike yesterday. The target appears to have been an error, with reports that an ISIS meeting was going on in a building just down the street from the one attacked. It is the first major civilian death toll in Iraq, first major civilian death toll in Iraq from U.S. airstrikes in the new war. Not like when they bombed that silo full of cowering civilians in Syria. Security sources in Anbar province also reported an increase in civilian displacement from Hit, with hundreds of families fleeing because of, quote, the intensification of the bombing of airplanes, as well as mortar strikes on the town. The lack of decent intelligence on what the U.S. is actually hitting in airstrikes is likely to give way to more such incidents in the weeks, months, and years to come as officials continue to ratchet up the air war. Yeah, I got that right. That's Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. 22 civilians killed. Of course that's going to keep happening, and of course that's exactly what the Islamic State wants. You know, just go back to Zarqawi. Why would Zarqawi bomb a bunch of Shiite marketplaces full of women and children? To provoke the Badr Brigade into killing a bunch of Sunnis, so that the ones who survived the attack of the Badr Brigade would then rally behind Zarqawi and his guys. Told you needed us. Look at these bad guys who keep coming for you. That's how it works. Sort of like George Bush and Barack Obama need an enemy. So do they. Yeah. Anyway. Everybody knows that, but that's all right. Leon Panetta, thank goodness, no longer the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. I guess DCI doesn't really exist, that old position. Anyway. Former head of the CIA, former head of the Pentagon, former Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, predicts 30-year war against ISIS. Remember now, at the time when Bush let Osama escape, he only had a couple of dozen of his closest friends with him. The rest had already been exploded to death by the U.S. Air Force and CIA and Northern Alliance laser pointers. Hey, Air Force, drop your bomb on that guy, the CIA pointed with their laser. And the Air Force did so, and Al-Qaeda was nothing but 200 or 300 guys then. And the CIA and the Air Force killed almost all of them. Just a couple of dozen escaped. Maybe as many as 4 dozen. Leon Panetta is talking long war. Sorry, Africans. We're coming for your continent. In the name of terrorism. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm here live from noon to 3 weekdays at the Liberty Radio Network. Check out my website, scotthorton.org. I keep all my interview archives there, as well as all my whole show archives, too. More than 3,500 interviews going back to 2003. And you can follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. I quit Facebook because I hate Facebook. I hate the way they won't show me the posts of the people who are my friends, whose posts I want to see. And I hate the way they won't show my post to anybody either. Even though 6,000-something people signed up to see my post, they'll outright admit, you know, once you change from the friend kind to the like kind, they'll tell you at the bottom, we only showed this to 20 people. Give us $40 and we'll think about showing it to some others. How about screw you? Shrug. Don't miss it at all. The only reason I use Facebook now is for the Wednesday night skate crew under a friend's alternative identity. Done! Screw you guys, I'm going over to Twitter. Alright. Hey, at least on Twitter, they show me the tweets of the people who I clicked follow. Isn't that sort of the supposed to be the gimmick? I click friends and then I get to see your posts? Oh, that's not the product. Okay, I'm the product. Okay, I quit. All right, anyway, you can't find me. Well, I am still on there, but won't do you no good to like me on Facebook. But I am on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. I forgot to call Eric Margulies. God, I'm such an idiot. I'm going to remember to call Eric Margulies here in just a minute. In fact, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write his name on my piece of paper really big, as though he's already lined up to be a guest on the show today. And then that way, maybe, big arrow pointing at it. Chat room, guys, it's on you to remind me in 10 minutes. 8. Coming up, Mitchell Prothero is going to be on the show here in just a few minutes to talk about the horrible war, and then Reese Ehrlich, too. So that should be pretty good. All right, now, I don't know, man. There's so much news to talk about. I guess, you know what, as long as we're doing Prothero on the war in a minute, let me just go ahead and talk about the cops for today's segment of Scott Hates Cops and Wants Everyone Else to Hate Cops as Much as He Does, so that then we can live in a society with less cops and less authority for cops and less policing for everyone. Grand jury, no criminal charges in SWAT raid that critically injured a toddler with a flashbang. Now, you remember this, this kid, Baby Boo Boo, the 3-year-old from Atlanta. He wasn't even from Atlanta. He was stopping through, staying at the in-law's house. The cop, what happened was, he tried to kick in the front door, and something was blocking the door, kinda. So he just threw a grenade in. Except it was the baby's crib that was there in front of the front door. And he threw the grenade onto the pillow right next to the baby's face and almost blew it completely off, as well as a giant hole in his chest, straight through his chest into his lung. It's amazing that the doctors saved this boy's life. As the police then still screamed and cursed and treated the family like they were less than, vermin in front of the Gestapo. Lied to them. And said the baby was just fine when there's blood everywhere. Still threatened to arrest them if they didn't shut the F up and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. After they damn near murdered their baby with a grenade. But the grand jury says, well, the prosecutor told us that as long as you work for the government, you can throw grenades at anyone's baby's face that you effing feel like. And that's the law. There is no law. The government can do whatever they want. They can throw a grenade at your baby's face. They can do whatever they want. There is no law. You are a slave. They own you.
That's it. Government employees in America are no longer bound, if they ever were, to respect the rights of any non-government employee. That's it. You are not free at all. You might as well be under the regime of Omar Baku al-Baghdadi or Bashar al-Assad. Here in the homeland, formerly known as the USA. And who takes responsibility for it all? Your neighbors, that's who. The people of the neighborhood who are impaneled on the grand jury to rubber stamp every bit of it and love it. Who can't wait to race to line up to no bill every crime the cops ever commit. The ones that get anywhere near the grand jury in the first place. Oh, this one was so bad on TV, we're going to have to give it to the grand jury. And everybody knows, you could go to junior high school and learn that any prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich. And what that means is, any prosecutor can tell the grand jury, I want to prosecute this guy. Let me. And the grand jury will say, okay. And the reverse, of course, is also true. If the prosecutor goes before the grand jury and says, well, you know, the guy was a cop who had every right to be kicking in this baby's door in the middle of the night looking for someone who wasn't even there on some bogus, trumped-up drug entrapment charge. And so he can throw a grenade at the baby's face if he feels like it, right, everybody? And the grand jury says, that's right. And then they all bend down to kiss the boots of the assistant district attorney. Your boots taste so good. Let me kiss them some more. Because they're Americans. And that's what they believe in. Power. Not freedom. They believe in destruction. They believe that any old deputy sheriff can kill any baby he feels like. Can do whatever he feels like. And I know it's not really fair to say the grand jury are the people, but it kind of is. I mean, mostly grand juries are made up of a bunch of, you know, former cops and people who identify very closely with that system anyway. They're family members, that kind of thing. Radley Balco had a recent article about that. About how grand juries are all basically just the friends and family of the court system impaneled there to like Bill on King of the Hill says, you know, I was on a jury 3 times and we did our job every time. We convicted them. Yep, that's your job, to pretend that you're the government for just a day so that you can hurt someone in a way that you wouldn't be allowed to normally. But if you're working under the auspices of the government, then you get to be powerful and hurt and control someone. Or let a cop go free for doing that thing in exchange for getting to have a fantasy like you got to help throw a grenade at a baby's face. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org for the archives. Scott Horton Show on Twitter. And LRN.FM, live here, noon to 3 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network. Our first guest today is Mitchell Prothero, reporting for McClatchy Newspapers, McClatchyDC.com, out of Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us on the show again. A lot of great journalism from you lately, and I guess let's start with your big scoop. It's not the biggest one in the scheme of things in the war, but sure is a big story for you. French agent who defected to Al-Qaeda was a target of that initial round of airstrikes in Syria. So, you know, two big things there. Do tell.
Yeah, it was kind of a crazy story, and it came from a roundabout way. Basically, we were talking to Syrian rebels that had been vetted and trained by, we assume, the Americans, but we'd say, you know, Western, you know, the Western-backed rebel groups. And these guys started complaining that they'd been tracking this Frenchman who was a Qaeda guy who'd been running a cell out of a mosque in Idlib, and that they were preparing a snatch operation to kidnap him when the bombing happened. And they were all irritated that nobody'd warned them the bombing was going to happen, and they said the guy got away. So I started looking into it, and basically it came out that at least at some point he had received significant training from the French, either through the military or through their external security, you know, service, their basically intel, and that at some point he'd gone rogue and had joined Al-Qaeda. And according to U.S. officials yesterday, confirmed to ABC News that he's a high-ranking member of Al-Qaeda and that he's got extensive you know, tradecraft experience and probably had a pretty high rank in either the French military or the French secret services.
Wow. And did anybody tell you how long this guy worked for the French government before he defected?
This thing is so, honestly, it's so crazy. We've really only got the tip of the story at this point. I'll be the first to admit it. And I'm working on it 24 hours a day at this stage to try to dig out more on him. No, we don't know that. We don't exactly know what he did for the French either. The range could go from, let's say, he was just doing his national service and was a conscript, essentially, who'd been assigned to military intelligence and just made coffee, in which case it's still kind of a big deal because a guy like that's very familiar with the capabilities and practices and tradecraft of Western intelligence. Mm-hmm. So he'd be considered an invaluable asset to Al-Qaeda.
And that's best case scenario.
That's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is you go up the ladder. You know, I've heard conflicting reports, and some people have explained that it may very well be that all of these things are true, that we even see this in the American or British, and, you know, intelligence and special forces. You get a guy, let's say, who's in, you know, Delta or the British SAS. He'll get assigned to work with the CIA or MI5 or MI6 for a while. Then he'll bounce to another unit. You know, these are what we jokingly call them the secret squirrels. And they sort of move around a lot depending on their expertise and what the missions are and what are needed and sort of slapped together as task forces. You know, in Iraq, maybe not today, but we're probably headed in that direction. But back in like 2003 to 2010, there'd be these task force units, which would be a mix of CIA, SEAL Team 6, Delta Force, you know, guys who know how to fly, and even like Ranger Regiment guys who would be providing, you know, what we'd say trigger puller security, you know, actual straight up normal soldiers that are pretty well trained, all in a mix as a task force out there looking for high value targets. So it's a possibility that he's one of these types of guys. And that's why we have so many different reports on his background. But we're in the middle of determining that. I'm working on it. And from what I can tell, I took a lot of my French colleagues by surprise, and they all appear to be working overtime on it as well at this stage.
Right. Yeah. And again, it's worth mentioning, as you already did, that this was confirmed very quickly by James Gordon Meek over there at ABC News. So if anybody wanted to doubt it, they can forget it.
Right. Well, it was even funny because early on, you know, obviously, you know, Europe's ahead of the U.S. So, we dropped the story on Sunday night for the Monday newspapers. And so I had all day listening to France denounce it. And claim it wasn't true. But their claims became increasingly bizarre. It started off as a flat denial, absolutely no way. I think a spokesman for the defense ministry even called me wacky at one point, which I am kind of wacky, so that's fair. And but then it devolved into this hilarious parsing of exactly what it means to be a French intelligence agent. One guy was trying to feed the idea that this was just a guy who used to lift weights with special forces soldiers and had inflated his resume when he went and joined Al-Qaeda, which, you know, I'm willing to actually entertain that as a possibility. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time that American intelligence has puffed somebody up to be bigger than they really are as a threat, you know, whether by accident or to sort of gin up, you know, enthusiasm for the war on terror. But they just started parsing everything so completely that even French journalists were calling me up laughing, saying, you know, we're trying to match or beat your story. And all the French government's doing is convincing us that you're right.
Yeah.
Like with their denials, it becomes somewhat black comedy. But then, you know, yeah, Meek came out with, you know, obviously he and I are colleagues and know each other. I have a lot of respect for his work. But we are a little bit of competitors. So when he dropped it, it was kind of funny. And at that point, the French just sort of went quiet.
Yeah.
Two American officials did tell him that this is absolutely true. They went further than my guys. Keep in mind, I did not get this from the American government at all. Some people have speculated that this had been a slap at Hollande, French President Hollande, for refusing to bomb Syria from the Americans. I can promise that was not the case at all. My reporting came strictly, at least initially, from Syrian rebels and then European intelligence agencies who were not French, who had been basically warned about this guy and were familiar with it. And, nobody really wanted to talk. The French are acting a little embarrassed right now. And honestly, I understand why, but they shouldn't be. You know, when you're talking about a huge country like, France, they've got a very large intelligence service that's very well known for its professionalism and aggressiveness. You know, any country can lose a guy. You know, the United States had Nadal Hussein shoot up a Fort Hood, input-output center, killing, I think, 13 people. You know, that doesn't reflect on the U.S. military any more than this reflects on the French intelligence services. Sometimes guys just go rogue.
Yeah. Now, and it's from your Syrian rebel sources that tell you that they were targeted. He was targeted that night and that he survived. Is that right?
Everybody's agreed he survived.
And now these are the strikes against the al-Nusra front where they came up with the name Khorasan Group to try to differentiate and all that. Is that correct?
The Khorasan Group, exactly. He's a member of what U.S. intelligence, now we've cleared all that up. There was some confusion the first week there. I think CENTCOM didn't do a very good job in their press releases. And I actually don't even think there was anything nefarious to it. But what had come out was, you know, U.S. intelligence guys had nicknamed a group of guys who were what we call core al-Qaeda operatives, dudes who'd been, you know, run around the mountains of Afghanistan and Pakistan, who were close to the central command or even part of it, of Zawahiri and back when he was alive, Osama bin Laden. Some of these guys had, in the past year or so, relocated to Syria, which is fairly logical that they would. Pakistan and Afghanistan have U.S. troops and drones flying all over the place. And let's face it, it's in kind of the middle of nowhere. It's a little bit harder to run operations from a place like that compared to Syria, where, you know, it's a wide open battlefield. Bunch of groups are running all over the place. And there's a large influx of new possible recruits for them to take advantage of. So some of these guys had relocated, and as U.S. intelligence was tracking them, they'd nicknamed them the Khorasan Group.
All right, you know what? I'm just going to blow this break and keep recording you because I got at least a half hour worth of stuff to talk about with you. Hey, everybody. Sorry, I know it sounds bad for the live show, but you'll be able to hear the archive of the whole thing later if you want, and we'll be right back with the end of the interview anyway. It's Mitchell Prothro, McClatchyDC.com. And now, but these strikes, when they were targeting the Khorasan group, these core guys who you were saying, friends of Zawahiri and so forth, who had relocated west, that the Frenchman was running around with them, and maybe
absolutely,
he was the reason that they were targeted.
I haven't been told that he was the expressed reason, that the absolute only reason. I think that this, let's call him a cell of al-Qaeda guys, just to simplify things. You know, al-Qaeda's at war with the West. They've attacked the West a bunch, and America's made it clear that where they would find Qaeda guys, they're going to try to kill or capture them. So these are Qaeda guys that are operating in Syria. They've been operating under the protection of Nusra, who, by their own admission, is the Syrian wing of al-Qaeda. Even if they have said that they will not target Western interests, at least that's what they'd said before the bombing, that they were just going to focus on getting rid of Assad. But he's definitely in a high leadership position in this group. That the Syrian rebels told me that he commanded at least five or six guys that were working together. They clearly appeared to be specialists. U.S. intelligence says he's a pretty high ranking guy. And even today, I'm seeing leaks in the French press where they're still trying to claim that this guy is not a former official agent of the DGSE, which is equivalent of the CIA for the French government, that he's not officially an agent of that group, which I actually never said. In the story, I said that some people had speculated he might have been, or that he'd been assigned to them. But they are even admitting that there's a guy who is French who might have some sort of tie to the French government at some point, who is also a high-ranking leader within al-Qaeda. So, you know, you can't parse it down too much. There's a cell of al-Qaeda guys, and he's a prominent, apparently quite skilled commander in that group.
And now, you know, after all the big hype, they told the New York Times that, oh, yeah, and, you know, the plot was basically just aspirational rather than operational, which is becoming a cliche now. We hear that so much on the backpedaling from some of the orange alerts we've had to suffer over the years here. And it seems like that really was just a put on. I guess they were taking advantage of the situation to go ahead and hit these guys that they wanted to hit. But was there any indication of an imminent threat that somehow these guys were going to leapfrog over Turkey and land in Western Europe?
Well, I wrote a story about this about a week and a half ago where, you know, European allies weren't briefed on an imminent threat. So I kind of wonder why the U.S. is making a big deal about that, or why they were, or even why anybody's making a big deal about it at all. The simple fact is America's at war with al-Qaeda, and al-Qaeda has tried to kill Americans and has successfully done so on several big occasions. And America's made it clear that they're going to kill or capture al-Qaeda guys whenever they get the chance.
Well, you know, so it was Roy, I think, who explained it better than anybody. Roy Gutman at McClatchy, your colleague there, who said, well, the reason they called it Khorasan was because, as though this was going to fool the Nusra people on the ground, I don't know, but I could see this being the American government decision. They didn't want to outright declare war on al-Nusra. They're trying to differentiate al-Nusra from al-Qaeda. So they're saying, well, no, we're just killing these few guys who are associated with al-Nusra, but they're the Khorasan group because they're not at war with al-Qaeda. They rather fight the Islamic State that hasn't ever attacked the United States and ignore the al-Nusra front that is openly loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri.
Well, I mean, it's... Look, at the end of the day, Nusra works with a lot of rebels that we work with, and they're really pissed off that, you know, Nusra was attacked. But I'd also say James Foley's parents would disagree with you that the Islamic State's never attacked America.
Oh, well, you know, That's a good point.
Yeah,
they didn't kill American hostages. But
and they're going to. And the simple fact is these guys have declared war on America. So, you know, the fact is you've got two different groups of jihadis, both who have total aspirations to kill Americans. They just might be busy right now.
Yeah. Well, and see, so my point wasn't really acquitting the Islamic State as much as implicating al-Nusra and the idea that somehow the al-Nusra are the warm, cuddly, somewhat moderate, if not completely moderate, FSA guys.
Well, the thing is, I mean, I don't know about that, really. I think that the U.S. has to walk a bit of a line in order not to alienate some of their Syrian allies. But keep in mind, the United States put out a specially designated terrorist hit notice on Nusra the second they were formed. From the second Nusra's announced its existence, America has described them as al-Qaeda in Iraq, which has now split into Nusra or the Islamic State, and called them essentially they're just al-Qaeda. Just because they're not targeting U.S. interests right now and that they're focusing on Bashar al-Assad, these guys follow Ayman Zawahiri. They follow bin Laden's ideology. They're Salafi jihadists, and they do not mean well to the West. They've just simply focused as a group on Assad. So, you know, a good counterargument is, well, who cares if they're not attacking us now? I mean, there are guys that are going to. They've literally announced, if you ask a Nusra guy, are you al-Qaeda? He will say yes. Do you follow Ayman Zawahiri and bin Laden? Did you support 9/11? Yes. Would you like to see another 9/11? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Are you going to do it yourself? No, I'm busy fighting Bashar al-Assad. Yeah. The U.S. has been very clear on that. And in fact, I was one of the people early on who criticized them, because I felt like if Nusra wasn't going to be causing international jihadist aspirational problems and they were working quite well with the other rebel groups, why not leave them alone? But the minute they dropped that designation on them, it became essentially impossible for the U.S. to support the rebels, because now you can't work with a guy who works with Nusra. It's material support for terrorism.
Sure. Well,
so it's really complicated the U.S. effort in order to support the rebels. So, you know, this is something that I don't know whether they regret it. But in walking it back, I really felt like they walked it back in order to appease guys that they're trying to work with on the ground, who will tell you flat out, we don't have a problem with Nusra. You know, like, most of America's Syria rebel allies don't have a problem with Nusra. But at the same time, it's just kind of weird because if you talk to a Nusra guy, as I have, they'll tell you flat out they love bin Laden and think 9/11 was great and hope another one happens.
Right. Yeah. The mystery is why America is allies with people who are allies with Nusra at all. And before
there's no other choice. There's nobody else to be aligned with. And the other thing I point out is America's not really aligned with these guys in the sense that they're not helping them. When everybody, I mean, the amount of help that America's given to the Syrian rebels has come down to like, what, less than 1,000 guys in 150,000 men, roughly, battle space. This is why America is not intervening in the Syrian civil war. It's why they're not bombing Assad, is because they don't want Nusra to win. And they've made that absolutely clear. Like, the simple fact is America is not going to bomb unless something radically changes on the ground. They're not going to target the Assad regime because as much as they despise it, they really do not want to see Nusra or ISIS win. And they think that'll be worse.
Well, now, you know? But on the other hand, going back, I mean, when Joe Biden says, hey, Turkey and Qatar and UAE and Saudi have been doing this all along, what he's really trying to say is, hey, don't look at who's the empire that they are all satellite states of, that even the New York Times has been saying for now, count them, 3 years straight, the CIA is coordinating this effort and working to bring all their money and guns. And that's what makes it supposedly deniable, even though everybody knows that Uncle Sam's been behind it all along since 2011.
Well, I do this for a living, and I don't know that even remotely. I mean, from what I can tell, the CIA and the U.S. government has been holding its nose, hoping that this thing doesn't get any worse. To call Qatar or Saudi satellite American states to me is almost preposterous because they do whatever the hell they want and have their own money. They don't listen to us.
Well, did the Americans try to stop them at all? I mean, come on, you've lived through the same 3 years as me where the entire narrative has been, why aren't we doing more to support the rebellion against Assad? No one has been saying, geez, Assad is the only guy standing between these Shia and Christians and a good beheading, other than maybe Rand Paul or something. Everyone has been saying backing the rebels is the good fight, even though that in essence means backing Nusra.
But America hasn't backed the rebels. That's the whole thing, is maybe in a little bit in rhetoric. Look,
but I mean, have they told the Saudis to knock it off?
Absolutely.
Yeah, but when? Constantly. Okay, they did a year ago, but not 3 years ago.
Well, I mean, I'm not in those rooms. I mean, but my impression has been the reason why the United States will not involve itself more in the Syrian civil war is because we simply do not trust the Qataris, Emiratis, and Saudis. Because they've been running
reason,
and throw in the worst of all of them is Turkey. Like right now, like this alliance that they've got to bomb ISIS is the most narrow thing in the entire world, because every conversation I've ever had with a U.S. official comes down to, we know these guys are funding all kinds of guys that are just not going to be on our side. We just can't, until it gets better regulated and controlled, we can't get involved. I mean, right now, the United States and Europe have been begging Turkey for 3 years to close the border to foreign fighters, and the Turks have refused. The Turks won't even turn over the list, and I know this firsthand. It might have changed in the last couple of months, but about 3 months ago, I was talking to a European intelligence official who told me the Turks will not produce a list of people who flew from a European country or flew from anywhere to Istanbul, to the airport in Hatay, which is the one closest to the border, and didn't fly back out. They won't even give that list to the Americans or to the French or to the British, so that people can at least start with a list of 10 or 15,000 people that they can start narrowing down to try to figure out who went and joined. The Turks go, well, you didn't let us into the EU because of human rights. Well, now we're not going to violate these poor tourists' human rights. And you go, but yeah, okay, so a 19-year-old, you know, kid of Pakistani descent from Birmingham, you know, took a one-way trip to the Syrian border and has never been seen again. Could you give us his name? No. So, no, I really disagree on that. The fact is, these countries do not do what the United States wants all the time. America can pressure them. It's influential in some cases. But what does America have that the Saudis need other than protecting the oil fields we're going to do anyway?
Yeah. Like, well, at this point, we can help them keep the Islamic State out of Saudi.
Well, except that, yeah, exactly. And we will. But we will anyway. That's the point. Basically, Saudi funds al-Qaeda. This has been known since day one. They've created – it's practically a wing of Saudi intelligence. Of course, there are members of the Saudi royal family who want to fight al-Qaeda because they know they're going to get their heads chopped off if the country ever falls. But inherently, the people of Saudi Arabia support the Islamic State. It's so much closer to their ideology and morals and values than anything that you see in the West.
Yeah.
So, I mean, on some level, there's an, you know, it's like saying, you know, if you're a drug addict, are you friends with your drug dealer? I mean, that's basically the relationship that goes both ways. You know, the Saudis are addicted to American protection, and the Americans are addicted to the oil and to the arms sales that fund, you know, Boeing and all of these companies that sell billions of dollars of weapons to the Gulf every year that are bought with the money that America sends them for the oil that we buy from them every year. So it's this symbiotic, you know, completely crazy relationship. And at the end of the day, I mean, a country like Qatar doesn't really care what America thinks. They sit on the, I mean, they care to a certain extent in terms of their own security, but you see them, they openly have diplomatic relations with Iran, despite our protests. They openly fund the Nusra Front and to a large extent probably fund ISIS, or at least did early on before ISIS was self-funding. So you can't really argue like that America's turning a blind eye to it. It's just, what the hell is America going to do? You can tell them don't do it, but you're not going to bomb Riyadh. And that's basically what it's come down to.
Sure. I guess I just haven't seen much complaining and attempting to tell them to stop. But I guess if you're reporting to me that they have been, I believe you. But
well, no, they look at what happened with Joe Biden. Joe Biden told the truth. And then they made him, he had to apologize because they were going to lose what little support they were getting from those guys to begin with.
Yeah.
But when Joe Biden came out the other day and basically blamed Turkey, Saudi, and UAE for ISIS, he wasn't lying.
Yeah, he was just 3 years after the fact is all.
No, but I mean, you saw the reaction though, because it's the carrot and the stick is these guys. I mean, if you come out and say it, you know, you keep hoping that Turkey will eventually do the right thing. But they're a NATO partner. I mean, we can't go to war with the Turks, although I know a lot of Kurdish people that wish we would. But the simple fact is, I mean, like, look at what's happening in Kobani right now. You know, the Turks are sitting there watching Kurdish fighters get beaten by ISIS. They've got tanks less than a kilometer away. They can roll in at any time and save them. They've got a NATO army and a NATO air force, mm-hmm. and they're sitting there watching the Kurds get crushed and basically saying, well, we're probably going to intervene. And what it's clear is they're going to intervene as soon as ISIS is done killing all the Kurds for them. Then they'll go in and probably get rid of, you know, push ISIS off the border. But right now, ISIS is doing Turkey's dirty work for them. Yeah. So they're perfectly content to let it go.
Well, they're completely crazy, too, though, because they've got all these refugees now, and their negotiations with the PKK obviously are now off. So it's going to blow up right in their face still, right?
The PKK rank and file want to go to war with Turkey immediately. I talk to them every day. They're ready. They're ready to restart the revolution. The peace deal that was started in 2012 and then signed last year, chances are I cannot imagine that's going to survive. But from what I can tell right now, the PKK has its hands full with ISIS. But, you know, they are livid at the Turks. At this stage, I mean, you almost can't imagine, like, on what planet is Turkey not aligned with ISIS militarily in northern Syria right now? I mean, I hate to say it. Turkey might throw me out, you know, never let me in again for saying it. But they are sitting there basically coordinating military operations with the Islamic State.
Yeah, but let me ask you this. Where the hell are the Americans? They're bombing inside Syria, but they're just barely – it's not like they're trying to kill all those tanks, are they?
Well, they've been bombing. They've been trying to help a little in Kobani. But, you know, keep in mind, it's not that easy to bomb individual stuff if you don't have people on the ground. It's easy to blow up strategic targets. Like, if you want to take out, you know, Ukraine's oil or, you know, natural gas transmission facilities – that you can bomb without guys on the ground. You can do it from satellites and reconnaissance.
Just type
and stuff
in
like
the numbers,
that.
Right?
Yeah. Right. But in order to bomb, like, which tanks which, that's not easy from an F-16. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, what if you accidentally drop that bomb, which happens all the time, you know, on a school? They're not trying to hit the school. It's just that, you know, combination of things. Unless you have eyes on, as accurate as these bombings are, you're talking about close air support, which means you'd have to basically put Delta guys in or SF guys on the ground with the YPG to call in airstrikes, which is what we saw in 2001 when the U.S. basically managed to take over Afghanistan with 100 Special Forces guys. They did it because they were able to ride with the Northern Alliance and go, bomb that tank now. bomb that tank now, bomb that one. They can't do that right now because they don't have guys on the ground, and Turkey will not help them. Turkey is sitting on their tanks 500 meters away watching the Kurds get massacred because they like dead Kurds.
And are they are the Americans asking the Turks to, come on, at least point lasers for us? They're not even and the Turks are refusing, or do you know?
I can be pretty cynical about American foreign policy, but I can't imagine that the administration is thrilled with this development. But if the Turks say no, what's your next step? You're going to need them later anyway. That's something, you know, one of my big theories is that people sometimes greatly overestimate the American government's ability to control the world. I think the right has a tendency to overestimate American influence and what they can accomplish. Well, why don't we just go in and fix it? You know, that tends to be a right-wing thing. Well, the world is pretty hard. As you've noticed, we spent $1 trillion and thousands of lives trying to fix Afghanistan and Iraq, and it didn't really go very well. I was there. And the left has a tendency to think that the, you know, American government's responsible for everything everybody does that's evil in the world. That's simply not the facts. You've got to deal with governments, and governments are always going to act in their own self-interest. It's not
an
American interest.
I'm a libertarian. That's what I think.
You know, but governments are going to act in their self-interest. It's simply what they do. Right now, America probably hates Turkish policy towards Syria, but it's not quite in their interest to burn the relationship down completely with Turkey, and Turkey knows it. And so they're going to keep getting away with whatever they can get away with that's in their self-interest, which right now strongly appears to be lots of dead Kurds. Right. The same thing with Saudi. You know, I mean, you can only influence people to a certain extent. They're going to do what they want unless you threaten them with violence. It's just, it's a harsh way to look at the world, but it is kind of how it works.
All right. And listen, we're already over time, but let me ask one more thing here real quick. You got this report with Lande about sending in the Apache helicopters, which seems a pretty big escalation in terms of commitment. And certainly those things are a lot easier to shoot down than an F-16. So that means, you know, perhaps rescue missions and all kinds of more force protection and all this kind of thing. And then you guys also write in there, and we talked about this with Lande yesterday on the show, but you guys write about how this is kind of an admission that the strikes with the high-speed fighter jets is not working, they're just not driving their giant convoys of Toyotas down the highway anymore now that that's a problem, and they're still making plenty of ground. That's another one of your reports here, how
They're
moving
well
and moving into the Sunni neighborhoods in the southwest of Baghdad there, right up to Baghdad's western border. So anyway, I guess just talk to me a little bit about what this all means to you.
It's what I was going back to saying, the limits to American air power in Syria. You can, and they do have a little bit better accuracy in the north. They've got an operations room in Erbil, and the Peshmerga are pretty well trained and used to working with the Americans. So you've seen that the strikes have been pretty good and pretty effective, you know, around Mosul Dam, Sinjar, stuff like that. Chances are even we consistently hear rumors that there might even be U.S. Special Forces guys embedded with the Peshmerga who are close American allies actually bringing those strikes down. In Anbar, it's really hard if you don't have guys looking at what you're trying to blow up in the middle of the battle who know how to direct air. Coming from an F-16, it's going to be really hard to, you know, properly kill stuff. So to an extent, it's an admission that that's not working because it is easier to do it from an Apache at a lot higher risk. But my takeaway from the story was something a little bit different. When they first sent those Apaches, now, the mission has changed. They have said that they're going to use assets to attack ISIS. They didn't say that initially. Those Apaches were put at Baghdad International Airport to protect the airport and to make sure that that route stayed open in case the U.S. had to evacuate the embassy in Baghdad. Basically, keep that place open at all costs. If they're flying Apaches, basically my takeaway, because I first noticed it on the CENTCOM release Sunday evening, my feeling was, what did they tell Obama on Saturday morning or Sunday morning? I think the strike started overnight. So let's assume they had his national security briefing on Saturday morning. Whatever they told the president of the United States about the situation in Anbar was so bad that he authorized putting U.S. troops in harm's way and taking the risk, as you said, of shoot downs and rescue missions and possibly like beheadings of U.S. pilots by ISIS guys. Because those choppers can be shot down. So that was my takeaway, is the situation in Anbar is so bad that the president was willing to take the political risk to try to stem it. So I'm still trying to figure out what's happening in Anbar, but it really sounds like it's a disaster.
Yeah. And man, I wanted to ask you about Muqtada Sadr and his group and all that, but I'm just so over time. I got to go. But thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Plus, I don't know anything about, I mean, I know those guys pretty well, but I'm not up to speed on what he's been up to. Oh, God. Maybe I should go check the wires.
Yeah, I'll be looking forward to your next report. Thanks very much, Mitch.
It's always a pleasure, Scott. Take it easy.
That's Mitch Prothero, everybody. He's at McClatchyDC.com. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Key Score, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org.
Hey, how's it going? I'm back. Yeah, so I interviewed Mitchell for a little while over there. I know, live audience, I'm sorry, guys. I know that it sounds terrible when I go out to break and hard break to commercials in the middle of a sentence, in the middle of a word, and it's the worst produced show in America. And yet, what am I supposed to do? Really tell the guy to shut up and sit there and listen for 4 minutes? I mean, yes, I know I am supposed to do that. And I make other great guests sit there and do that too, just because that's the form of the show. But damn, man, I ran out of time. I had all kinds of stuff to ask the man still, and I interviewed him for 35 minutes. So that's just the way it goes, I guess. To me, it's all about the content, right? I don't go by the guest. I go by the article they wrote. And I don't go by the clock. I go by the interview I want to hear. Oh, speaking of which, I take off these headphones. They hurt my ears. You know what I think's fun about TV? All cable TV news channels. Nothing but generals. Nothing but generals and intelligence officers. Former CIA, former general in the Army, former general in the Marine Corps, former admiral in the Navy. Jeez, Admiral, are you guys having a lot of fun shooting Raytheon products at these ARABs? Oh, yeah. It's absolutely necessary that we do, you understand. On CNN yesterday, I had 3 or 4 heads in a box, all of them just generals, saying, yeah, let's get them. I don't know. You know, Eric Margulies is going to be on the show. Did I mention that? Eric's going to be on the show. So I want to talk with him about the DPRK. You know what? Here's what I want to do. I'm going to try to remember to tell him this. I want to talk about the DPRK and Hong Kong in the first segment. But then I want to talk about the war in Iraq with him too. Because Eric was one of the first people that said Western intelligence is working with the Saudis to send Mujahideen to Syria back in 2011. Hey, chat room guys, you think you might Google that for me real quick? I know it ran at lourockwell.com. Eric Margulies, probably French special forces might be a term that you would use, and certainly 2011, before Giraldi published his piece saying that Obama had signed a new finding stepping up covert action against Assad. Before that, there was another thing in The Guardian where the guy said, again, summer 2011, Prince Bandar in Saudi is rounding up all the boys for the next big attempted co-optation of the Arab Spring uprising by human beings just wanting to have a little bit of freedom, self-government, fair trials, a bite to eat. Anyway, so they did that. But so, hey, you heard the dispute there, or maybe it was during the break. I don't know.
if you guys heard it or not. But Prothero says, no, man. When the Turks, the Saudis, the Qataris have been backing the rebels all this time, it's over America's dead body, man. The Americans have not been able to stop them. It really is. Biden is right to blame them. He's not just deflecting. Now, I don't know, man. It sure seems to me like, I don't know. Because I told him, hey, man, are you kidding me? The last, up until the fall of Mosul, all anybody ever said was we need to do more to help the rebels. And the entire agenda was Assad is the bad guy, not Al-Qaeda there. And he says, yeah, but so the help still never came. Not really. And I guess we could have quibbled about, you know, trucks and whatever, FSA equipment. But I was thinking more in terms of the money. The Americans working with the Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks. But he was saying, no, man, the Turks are the worst of all. The Americans have been begging them to close the border. The Europeans, too, been begging them to close the border. Been begging them to turn over lists of Europeans, other Westerners who have gone there to fight. Or, you know, who have apparently gone there to fight by way of their one-way travel plans. That kind of thing. They won't do it. And, I mean, who could argue that George Bush didn't completely premature ejaculate and blow all of America's wad all over the Middle East? And now, America's just a limp Barack Obama stumbling around, taken seriously by no one. I'm sorry for the not very intelligent sort of a metaphor there, but isn't that what happened? Didn't George Bush blow America's empire's wad? Now, that's what I should say. Now Obama's rolling over to take a nap. That's what's happening. And no one over there takes the American empire seriously. And why should they? Apparently, you know, the neighborhood with AKs can fend the Americans off. Give them a few years to do it. So, what's the worry? Anyway, it's amazing to me. Is it amazing to you guys, or just, hey, whatever the narrative is, that sounds pretty much right to us? Or how's this work? When Leon Panetta says that the problem with Barack Obama's foreign policy is that he hasn't done enough. He didn't invade and overthrow and regime change Assad soon enough. Because then if he had, then what? I guess fighting the Sunni-based insurgency would be no big deal for America to just take Assad's place in the occupation of Syria. That's the problem with Obama? Not anything like he's worked with or turned a blind eye to all of America's allies supporting the Mujahideen there this whole time and building up this crisis this whole time. The problem is he didn't completely abolish the state of Syria and turn it into a George W. Bush-style Iraqi bloodbath, jihadistan. Oh, no, if only Barack Obama had just, in 2011, I guess, right after he was done with Gaddafi, if only he'd just gone in there and carpet-bombed Damascus and drove the Alawites out of power, and then what? Then peace would have broken out everywhere? Or Al-Qaeda in Iraq would have come anyway with suicide trucks and really sharp knives? Where they've been ruled by the minority Alawites and Shiites and Christians this whole time. I mean, it's really the Alawites, but it's a coalition kind of supporting them. All the minorities. And you know, a lot of the Sunni Arabs never supported the rebellion at all either. They remain in the Assad coalition too. And I don't think that there's very many people, certainly outside the Alawite community, who really like Assad. It's just they prefer him and his army to a bunch of lunatic suicide bomber prisoner beheaders. And it has been this way, and for so long. So, I don't know. I mean, I guess if I was able to just keep bickering on that same point, I would have said something like, well, I did kind of say this. I haven't seen where Obama was telling him to stop. Or maybe like a year ago. Yeah, that was part of the conversation. Maybe like a year ago, after ISIS broke off from Nusra, there was a little bit like, hey, get rid of Prince Bandar now, and you know, maybe back off this policy a little bit. But then they were still sending aid to the FSA all along, including those Toyotas I keep talking about, just 2 months before the regime change in Mosul, where this guy Baghdadi climbed up on the balcony like Mussolini and announced he was the new autocrat. Anyway, so here's Leon Panetta, former head of the CIA, former Secretary of Defense. I think they say he was Bill Clinton's chief of staff, I think before that a congressman. He's known as a technocrat, not much of an ideologue, not even like a real neoliberal, but just a pretty damn center-left Democrat office holder type. And he sounds like Richard Pearl off his meds. 30 more years of war in the Middle East. Those are the Democrats. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, Shell, welcome back. Coming up, Eric Margolies here in just a few minutes, okay? Be patient for crying out loud. Eric Margolies coming up, and then Reese Ehrlich, too. So, yeah. It's basically anti-war radio. I'm Scott Horton, trying to pose this thing. And I'll tell you, you know, all this analysis I've been reading about how best to deal with the Islamic State, it's so rare that I see anybody get it right. It's driving me crazy. I'm sorry to repeat myself. I was saying this on the show the other day. Some of my favorite writers are still recommending policies. Policies? What are you, crazy? Policies? You want the U.S. government to do things? What are you, mad? After all this, you want to hire the Pentagon and Langley to go and fix it? Just stop. Oh, yeah, if only they do things the way I would have them do. Really? And then what are the options? Well, we gotta back Assad and Iran against them. No, we don't. Well, we gotta lie with somebody. Who are we gonna lie with? If not the FSA or Nusra, then who? Assad? ISIS? Can't lie with them. So, I guess we gotta lie with Nusra, or what? Wait, which one was it we got to lie with? Because we have to ally with someone? I don't think so. It's crazy. Especially when everyone knows this is all America's fault. They can't even hide that from you on Fox News. Any idiot in America, all of us know Saddam and Uday and Qusay used to rule Iraq. And there wasn't no Islamic State then, was there? There wasn't no beheadings and crucifixions and suicide bombings then. Christian ladies taught college in Baghdad under the brutal, fascist, secular dictator Saddam Hussein. Everybody knows that. It was America that undid that. And of course, only why? Because he was our best friend and therefore had to be stabbed in the back and murdered because those are the rules for doing as you're told. For losing 500,000 people invading Iran for Uncle Sam Ronald Reagan. Jimmy Carter really asked him to start it. Reagan helped him continue it. That was the only reason he had to die in the first place, right? Because he was America's loyal servant. Is that how that works? Anyway, everyone knows that at least George Bush, I guess, turned this part of Iraq into lawless jihadi terrorist land where it wasn't before. Fewer understand that the reason the Baghdad government has completely frozen the Sunnis out of power, 100%, and made them so desperate as to ally with lunatics like Omar Abu al-Baghdadi is because America refused to cut and run, because then the violence will get worse, Americans were told, and therefore repeated over and over again, as though it must be true if that's what the government says. And so what they did was they kicked all the Sunnis out of Baghdad. So that by the end of 2008, the Shiite government said, hey, thanks, now you can get the hell out. We don't need you anymore. You won the war for us. You gave us the capital city. If we hadn't given them the capital city, if the Shiites were still, if it was still a 60-40, 20, 50-something, 55-45 type split there, then they would have had to compromise with the former Ba'athists, the Sunni religious leaders, the tribal elders. They would have had to compromise. But they don't, because George Bush fought an entire war for the Ayatollahs, Khamenei and Sistani, to kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad. And so, leaving Sunni Stan seething, completely lost of power. Is that a phrase? I just made it up. Hope you like it. Completely screwed out of power. How about that? And so, everybody knows that. Even watching Fox, well, not everybody knows that, but everybody knows this is America's fault on one level. And now the only solution all the way around is pick your sides. When the truth is, there's only one solution to the war on terror, and that's for us all to go back in time to 2008 and elect Ron Paul. Because here's what would have happened. I mean, assuming that he could have invented some kind of magical force field to protect him from the Pentagon and the rest of the executive branch. What he would have done is he would have ordered the military home from everywhere. And he would have given a big speech just completely repudiating. In fact, let's just say he was made president now by unanimous acclaim. He would just get up there and completely repudiate Bush and Obama. Oh, what Bush and Obama did? My speech to the world by Ron Paul. What Bush and Obama did has nothing to do with what's going on now. I mean, yeah, they were running the same government that I'm running now, but you can forget continuity between any of their policies and mine. I ain't married to them one bit. The American people have said no more. And so, let the word go forth. We don't want an empire. And to prove it, we're bringing our empire home now. All you generals with your bases, pack them up, get on the boats, get on the planes, fly home. That's it. Air Force transport planes and giant troop carrier ships are the last ones to be decommissioned. They're all bringing these guys home, and then they're all fired and have to go get real jobs providing goods and services in the marketplace. Watch what a free society acts like, world. Green with envy that you live under some totalitarian theocracy or kleptocracy or both or whichever, wherever in the world. This is how we change the world. By the light of our benign example. By reinstating the Bill of Rights. And bringing an end to America's part in these wars. And I'm sure he would have said sorry too. I've heard him say it before. It's horrible what America's done to the Middle East. It was, I mean, supporting the dictators and supporting the revolutions too. Which is worse? Take your pick. Pick your poison. How about just back off? And now, Leon Panetta, and he's just one of them. You've been hearing this all along. Maybe you helped talk yourself into, with a little bit of help from TV, talk yourself into believing that somehow this was going to wind itself down or come to an end. But since the very beginning, they've been honest with us about one thing. This war is not going to end. Hey, everywhere they bomb, they generate opposition to be killed with bombs. And on it goes indefinitely. That's it. Cheney's grim vision. Decades of war. Read the Seattle Post-Intelligencer back in 2001. And here's Leon Panetta saying 30 years. Here's Hillary Clinton already anointed by the establishment to be the next dear leader. Long-term struggle ahead, she says. Oh, but she'll be the first woman president. So get excited about that. She'll kill more people than any woman has ever killed before since Mao's wife. You know, maybe. Stumble. Hey, all Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com. You gotta love the totalitarian states of America, the homeland that has consumed our country. Guy fires a warning shot, gets 20 years. You know, it's not like he was born with rights or anything. Not that any government employees are bound to respect anyway. All right, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. Oops. Better try that again. Thought I had him already. There he is. Hey!
Scott, is that you?
Hey, look, everybody, I got Eric Margulies online. Welcome back to the show, Eric.
Hello, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. Everybody, you know Eric, he wrote the books War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination, and he writes at ericmargulies.com, spell it like Margolis, ericmargulies.com, and also you can find what he writes at unz.com, U-N-Z, unz.com, and at lourockwell.com. Very happy to have you back, and oh no, what I do with that article of yours from LRC about what is going on in Hong Kong. I meant to say this off the air, I forgot, so I'll tell you now. What I'd like to do is I'd like to talk with you about the DPRK in Hong Kong for the first segment, and then the Iraq-Syria war for the second, if that's possible. So I guess just real quick, can you just give us a nutshell view of what's going on, your view of what's going on in North Korea right now?
Well, I don't know. It's very unclear. It appears something is happening, but we don't know what. The beloved leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, Baby Kim, as they call him, has been out of sight for a month. This is very unusual because he loves to showboat and grandstand and go around. So there are all kinds of rumors swirling around that there's been a coup, the military's unseated him, his sister's taken over, he's ill, we just don't know. Today there was an exchange of shots, gunfire between North and South Korean vessels, no reports of high alert along the DMZ. That's it, we just don't know.
All right, well, so... what could it possibly mean when you have a delegation go to meet with the South Koreans? They held very short talks, I guess, toward the having of talks within a month, they said, and not just some talks, but with the Reunification Council. What exactly is the Reunification Council? And interpret, please.
It's an organization in South Korea, and I think there's a mirror version in North Korea, that's supposed to talk about reunification and then talk and talk and talk. It's a talking shop, never produces anything. The meeting, the North Korean delegation of high-ranking people, I think was scheduled. You have to understand in Korean relations, they blow hot and cold constantly. One day they're accusing each other of being baby-killing, warmongering fascists. And the next day, there are fraternal Korean brothers and glory to United Korea. So you just don't know at this point. But there's great personal animosity between the South Korean president, lady president, President Park, and between Kim Jong-un. They keep hurling insults at each other. It's all great fun as long as it doesn't erupt in a war.
Right. Now... So here's the thing. I mean, I know people just sit around starving to death all the time up there in communist hell. But the regime always seems pretty stable, from the grandfather to the son and to the grandson. And I know there's a little bit of pull back and forth between the Communist Party and the military. and aunts and uncles and brothers and cousins in the ruling family. But it seems like the regime is typically pretty stable. But here we have a very strange situation, a very mysterious situation where the dictator goes missing, his sister comes out, but then we have what I guess seemed, was it just overblown by TV because of coincidental timing that this meeting of the council signified a major change? Like not just power had been seized, but maybe power had been seized by someone so that they could do this, seemed to be the implication, no?
Well, I tend to think it was coincidental rather than planned, but who knows? North Korea is always a mystery wrapped up in an enigma. And don't forget that a couple of months ago, the Kim Jong-un had his unbeloved uncle hauled out of a meeting on the TV cameras, taken out a shot. So there are obviously strains within even the family ruling structure. But, you know, we have to be careful because almost all our news about North Korea comes from South Korea. And it's the South Korean intelligence has a whole bureau fabricating bad news about North Korea and sending out nasty things. And they put out all kinds of phony baloney reports. So great caution.
Hmm. And now, so here's the thing, too, is at least it was certain under the Bush years. I can't imagine this has really changed. American policy is to never allow reunification. So I guess two questions. Do you think that, you know, without America involved, that there really could be any kind of real push toward reunification here? And then secondly, would America crush that if they even really tried it?
Well, I don't think there would be a real push because the future of the Kim family, ruling Kim family in North Korea, would be diluted in any kind of reunification because there are a lot more Southerners, they've got all the money. So obviously there would be a loss of power. Better to rule in hell than serve in heaven, as the poem goes. But for the South Koreans, they would like reunification. But they, when I was in South Korea, the one thing I kept hearing all they were scared of was not invasion from North Korea, but unexpected reunification, which means that the North collapses. And millions, 22, 25 million starving refugees come pouring south across the DMZ or take rafts and boats and head on the prevailing current to Japan.
Ooh, but all that cheap labor. And in the south, I mean, it would seem like if they reunify, be the southern government is the one that survives, but they get the nukes. So that's pretty good. I mean, I know it would be hard economically for a little while to adjust, but it seems like the South would like to absorb the North if they could get away with it without a fight, no?
Well, it's the cost of doing it. It would be titanic. By the way, the South can make their own nukes within 3 months if they wanted. The U.S. under the current President Park's father, Park Chung-hee, where the U.S. has caught the South Koreans starting to make nuclear weapons on the sly and stopped them. But South Korea certainly has the capability. But the problem is that the South Koreans saw the cost of German reunification. Germans are still paying for the absorption of East Germany, and it was a good idea. But only the rich Germans in the Korean view could really afford it. The South Korea is not a rich country, and it would struggle forever to rebuild North Korea. So their preference really is to maintain the status quo. Hmm.
You think even if the communist government fell, they still might not necessarily want to reunify, just
they might
be friends with the new regime? Yeah.
They would just encourage another communist or non-communist government to take over in the North. And what is also significant, Scott, is that Japan does not want to see a unified Korea. So it would probably jump in and start financing whatever group came to power in North Korea, because a united Korea would be a very important military and economic rival to Japan. And remember that the Koreans hate the Japanese and vowed to get revenge on them for humiliating them in the last century.
Oh, man.
And the Russians don't want to see a united Korea particularly, nor do the Chinese, because they're afraid that Korea would become an advanced American base pointing at the heart of Manchuria.
Right. Yeah, and the Americans, too. They have right now, the North is basically nobody. I mean, they're sort of a nuisance, but not really any kind of threat. And the South is stuck dependent on us as long as they have that enemy in the North. So it makes for a pretty good status quo all around, I guess, for the government's interests, not for the people necessarily.
That's right. Everyone loves the status quo, except for occasional outbursts from the North Korea who say we are going to... The North Koreans have always claimed that South Korea is an American colony and that they are the authentic Koreans and they are going to liberate South Korea from American domination.
Well, and they kind of have a point, right? When America inherited the Japanese sock puppet regime and kept it after World War II.
That's correct. But I haven't met many South Koreans who want to be absorbed by North Korea. And particularly
yeah. That's a different question, right? Just the first part.
About 40% of Koreans are Christians of different varying types, evangelical, Catholics, etc. Aside from after the Philippines, Korea, South Korea has Asia's largest Christian population, they think. And they are violently anti-communist, and they have no desire to become North Korean citizens.
Yeah, no, certainly not. All right, yeah, who wants to just starve to death? That sounds pretty miserable. All right, now let me ask you about what's going on in Hong Kong, and especially because it's in here somewhere, and I know it's a big complicated mess and a gigantic complicated Chinese empire, and Hong Kong is its own giant complicated city state and all of these things, but somewhere buried in here is American intervention too, so that's the most important part to me. But please just make me smart about Hong Kong, Eric.
Well, when Hong Kong was absorbed by China, or reabsorbed, reunited with China in 1997, the agreement was that there would be two systems and one state. And China would grant Hong Kong almost complete business autonomy, and that it would share a role in the governing of Hong Kong. The Hong Kongers were very happy with this situation, but China still maintained a lot of influence. So we have to step back and remember that when Hong Kong was a British colony, it had no democracy. It was ruled by a British-appointed governor. And so, really, Hong Kong had more democracy under China than it had under Britain. However, as tightening efforts by the new Chinese leader, Xi Jinping, to tighten, you know, really get a tighter grasp on affairs in China, Beijing has said that in 2017, in the next elections in Hong Kong, that it will select the candidates and not Hong Kong. This has led to major student revolts that have really shaken the colony. They have not spread to the mainland further on, but they offered the biggest challenge to the Chinese Communist Party leadership since the Tiananmen Square uprising.
So the Communist Party is sort of like Goldman Sachs. They pick the candidates that we pick from, kind of thing.
That's right, but they have higher ethics than Goldman Sachs.
Oh, I see. Yeah. All right, and now, so what about all these kids in the streets? Is this just another color-coded revolution, or?
I think it's a combination, Scott. I think it's a youthful exuberance. Students are always upright, panty raids, rioting, this type of thing. you know, we can't downplay that. But it's a new younger generation that is not yet imbued with business and making money, and it's still inspired by democracy. It hears what the West is saying. It has much more open communications, better, freer newspapers, better internet access. So it wants more freedom. They, like all young people, they're tired of being told what to do by their parents, whether at home or the Communist Party. So that's one element. And that is the primary element. Secondly, Hong Kong is a declining economic power in the Chinese context. It used to be the only gateway into China. All of China's export trade went out through Hong Kong. Anything would go in. So Hong Kong boomed. In fact, Hong Kong was built by refugees from Shanghai, the great trading center of China. Today, Shanghai is rapidly emerging as the premier economic powerhouse in China. It is. And a lot of Chinese export business is going out through Shanghai. This means that Hong Kong has less influence and it has less future jobs. And the young people there, like in the States, are worried about their future.
Yeah. And so what does the NED have to do with it then? Anything?
Well, we don't know how far, but the National Endowment for the Democracy and all these other American false flag, quote, democracy, unquote, organizations are implanted in Hong Kong, as they are in many countries around the world. They have become the leading edge of U.S. efforts to stir up opposition to local governments, particularly through social media. It did it in Iran. It's done it in Georgia, in Ukraine. We're seeing it now going on in the Middle East. It's a very effective soft power technique. They are in Hong Kong. It's hard to say just how much they've played a role in stirring up the anti-Beijing riots. According to the Chinese authorities in Beijing, they are primarily behind the unrest in China, in Hong Kong.
Hmm. Well, yeah, see, I don't know about that. I'm with you on the primary cause is, you know, why should anybody like the government of China, whether the Americans agree with them or not, you know? And, well, from what I read, which wasn't much, but what I read about the NED in China was they'd given hundreds of thousands of dollars and maybe right where it really counted. But then again, that does sort of sound like a drop in the bucket when you're talking about a massive movement like this in a city like that, right?
I think so, but these U.S. undercover regime change operations have become very sophisticated, and we can't underestimate their effectiveness.
Yeah. Well, and of course, just because the NED says we gave this many hundred thousand dollars doesn't mean they didn't give that many million, you know?
Well, so, that's right. So the CIA,
I don't mean to presume them innocent or anything, because I surely don't.
That's right. And don't forget Freedom House. That's
right.
Another operation. It's a major false flag U.S. government.
George Soros there, right?
Regime change operation. Yeah. And dominated by the neocons, too.
All right. Now, so I want to talk with you about a little bit of the history of the recent war in Syria leading up to the gigantic declaration of the caliphate and the fall of Mosul and everything in June. And that is because, and I'm just going from memory here, I really should have done the work before the show, Eric, but I'm just going from memory, and it seems like there were just a few, but they were pretty important sources that came out in the summer and maybe the early autumn of 2011 saying that the Americans and the Western powers are working with the Saudis on a regime change plan for Syria. Act two of the war against Gaddafi, basically. And from very early on, maybe before the, you know, veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, you know, really even ran straight from Iraq to Syria to begin the creation of the al-Nusra Front, Prince Bandar, according to The Guardian, was already organizing guys to go and fight there. Then you wrote an article, which I'm sorry I don't have it in front of me, but I know it ran at lewrockwell.com because I can picture it. And what you said in there was that French special forces and intelligence guys are working on this project too. And then there's one more major one that I can't for the life of me remember. But then in December, Giraldi wrote at antiwar.com and in the American Conservative that Obama had signed a new finding ordering support for the rebellion. Now, the amount and degrees and all that, I'll let you elaborate on all that too. I don't really know. But I was just wondering if you could remind us, or whatever you remember, about what you knew and when and to what extent America was working with, was even perhaps behind, organizing the effort for Saudi and Qatar and Turkey and Jordan to all work to support the rebellion in Syria, even though I guess I would concede the Americans are trying to support this FSA while the Saudis are supporting al-Sham and the Qataris are supporting al-Nusra and God knows, I don't know exactly what, but you were on to this from the very, very beginning. So tell me the truth of it, please.
Well, Scott, the truth is that under the Bush administration, under pressure from the neocons in the administration, there was a plan developed with the Israelis to invade Syria and overthrow its government and also invade Lebanon and crush Hezbollah. It didn't happen because a few wise voices, probably in the Pentagon, said, wait a minute, if you overthrow the government of Syria, who are you going to replace it by? The major organization is the Muslim Brotherhood underground, and they'll be less of a good ally than the Syrian government. What was crazy was Syria was a de facto American ally. It wasn't doing anything bad against, you know, or to hinder United States imperial policies in the Middle East. But the plan was still dropped. It was then resuscitated 4 years ago, I think. I'm going by memory, too. Maybe 3.5 years ago, when it was the U.S. that, and probably in cahoots with the Israelis, started the uprising in Syria near the Lebanese and Jordanian borders. And they took advantage of popular discontent with the Assad regime. But they actually sparked a rebellion there, as they had done in Libya, and armed it, and then brought in advisors and French intelligence agents were there. And that was the beginning of the open revolt against the Assad regime, which now continues 3-4 years later. And we've been pouring arms and we've been pouring secret special forces into the area. Yes, our heroic and democratic Arab allies, such as Saudi Arabia and Qatar and places like that, have been helping their pet groups. It's a replay of the Lebanese civil war in the 1970s. Everybody's supporting a different group, and the result is chaos.
Yeah. All right, now, so, I mean, I remember that Bush accidentally fought a war for the Ayatollahs Khomeini and Sistani and then thought better of it too late, and so they did this redirection you're talking about. Well, let's reassign with Saudi policy. We'll back Fatah al-Islam in, this was the Hirsch article in 2007, Fatah al-Islam in Lebanon and the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria and Jandala, although it turned out that was Mossad posing as CIA, recruiting Jandala in Eastern Iran. But when it comes to 2011 and the start of the war here, I mean, it's obvious. They're like, oops, we gave all southern Iraq to Iran. Well, the consolation prize is let's try to take Assad down a peg. But now, I was just talking with Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy Newspapers, who's been reporting from Syria and Iraq all this time. And he was saying to me that, yeah, you know, they may have been talking about supporting the rebels, but most of it was complaining that they're not supporting the rebels enough and, quote-unquote enough anyway, but for the good reason that the Americans got cold feet with this right away and that Obama has really not helped to arm all these groups and the CIA has really not helped to coordinate Saudi and Jordan and Turkey. They actually don't give a damn what Obama wants. They do whatever they want. And Obama basically has decided as far back ago as, I don't know exactly when, more than a year ago, maybe more than 2 years ago, according to Mitchell Prothero, that no, in fact, he does not want to do this. But he'll be damned if he could get the Saudis and the Qataris, et cetera, to stop. What do you think of that?
Well, I think the U.S. government is having less and less influence over its Arab vassal states. Yes, they do conduct their own policy on the ground regionally, but they keep an eye on Washington, and they wouldn't do anything violently opposing U.S. demands. But the important thing is the U.S. has been pouring arms and money. It was fueling the civil war in Syria. We've created 3 million refugees. We're the biggest refugee creator on earth. Add 5 million Palestinians, and it's a disaster. We have been tearing up Syria. As the Saudis and the other Arabs have been waging their own little petty rivalries in Syria, trying to one-up each other. But overall, the major problem the U.S. has run into is that these bogus political organizations it's been trying to create to front for this so-called revolution, like the Free Syrian Army, have been useless. All they do is bicker and argue with each other. A bunch of little Napoleons sitting in Istanbul have no influence whatsoever in Syria. And the Americans keep getting scared because they think that that even more radical groups are going to emerge, as happened with ISIS. And the Israelis are stirring the pot from behind the scenes. They're delighted to see Syria being destroyed, because they know that one day they are going to be the beneficiaries of this war.
Yeah, well, maybe in some ways, I guess. I don't know. It seems like it's all very dangerous. But now, so you think they were underestimating, like they're claiming ignorance now, that, you know, they're saying, well, geez, we just underestimated the Iraqi army's will to fight, this kind of thing? Because I've got articles and interviews with Patrick Coburn, for one. I'm sure you and I talked about this at the time, a year and a half ago now, spring 2013, Iraqi soldiers abandoning their posts up in Sunnistan and heading back towards Shiistan because they've got no backup. They're miles from home. It's not really their territory. It's a foreign country now that they're attempting to occupy, and they're failing at it, and they're giving up. And that's not, even still, that's 9 months before Fallujah hoisted the black flag, which was still 6 months before the fall of Mosul. But Patrick Coburn was writing about, hey, looks like the rise of the caliphate to me. And hell, from the moment that they renamed it, well, there was a faction fight there. It was complicated. But the first step was that Baghdadi renamed al-Nusra the Islamics, because it was one organization, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. So what does that mean right there? If you already know that the Iraqi army doesn't really have control of Sunnistan in western and northwestern Iraq, and you already know that eastern Syria is in the hands of Nusra and or ISIS, this group, and they're calling themselves a state, at least, you know, it's not that they really were a state yet at that point, but it was clear that there was no one there to oppose them from creating a state. And I wrote in the Future Freedom Foundation thing in April of 2013 that, look, it's the rise of that ridiculous Islamo-fascist caliphate of bin Laden and George Bush's fantasies is actually coming to life in real life. And that was a more than a year before the fall of Mosul. And yet Obama and Clapper and all these guys go on TV and say, yeah, man, this whole thing really took us by surprise.
Well, they're idiots. And they should all be fired. They don't deserve to work in a McDonald's, not to mention Washington. I'm horrified by the ineptitude of government, the intelligence agencies. It is really shameful for even our president to say that they were surprised. Clapper, the man who lied to Congress about the National Security Agency, is now guiding our Mideast policy. It's very scary. And the problem is that nobody in Washington is really in charge of this Mideast policy. There are many cooks with spoons in this broth. You know, there's the Pentagon, there's the oil industry, there are the idiots in Congress, there's the Israel lobby, there are the Saudis buying whoever they want. So it's a big mess, and it's going to continue being a big mess because, look, people in Washington just don't understand what's going on there. I remember before the 2003 invasion, when I was talking to some very senior administration people, and they said, well, Eric, what do you think is going to happen in Iraq? I said, well, have you considered about the Shiites? Have you considered about the Zaydis or the Yazidis or whatever? I mean, what about the Kurds? I remember one of these guys said to me, one of the very senior national security thing, he said, don't confuse us with all these details. Just give us the bottom line. I said, the bottom line is don't invade Iraq. That's what it is.
Yeah.
They don't understand.
So really, I mean, I guess just to ask the question is to answer it. The National Security Council, they don't read Coburn. I mean, you would think that even if they don't like him, that they would read him, because he's Patrick Coburn. He knows what he's talking about. Sit down and read. If you want to know what the hell's going on around here, you can't not read Patrick Coburn. What are we doing here? Our government is run by people who don't read Patrick Coburn? Jesus. God help us.
or listen to Scott Horton. We don't, people want just to read what confirms their views. Like, if you want a completely mistaken view about the Middle East, you read the Wall Street Journal and watch Fox News, and you'll get that in spades.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Don't disturb my prejudices. It's taken me a long time to develop them. That's the prevailing attitude. And don't confuse me with all these questions.
All right. Well, I'll let you go. I've already kept you over. But thanks very much, Eric. Good to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure, Scott.
That's the great Eric Margulies, everybody. He is at ericmargulies.com, at lourockwell.com, and uns.com. The books are American Raj, A Liberation or Domination, and War at the Top of the World. And we'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism and the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hey, look at this. Frank talk from Graham Fuller, the former chief of station in Kabul. Attempts to kick out Assad brought us the grand jihadists. Well, it's okay to admit that more than halfway through 2014, I guess. Just as long as no one gets in trouble for it. All right. Well, I got Reese Ehrlich on the line. And his website is reeseehrlich.com. His latest book is Inside Syria, The Backstory of the Civil War and What the World Can Expect. Well, hell, I should read that. This article is the spotlight on antiwar.com over the weekend, and for very good reason. 10 myths about Obama's latest war in Iraq and Syria. So on one hand, it's a listicle, and you like that. On the other hand, it's really got a lot of great background and explanation about what the hell's going on here for you, too. I mean, you'll really learn a lot reading it. It's good. 10 myths about Obama's latest war in Iraq and Syria. Welcome back to the show, Reese. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine. I appreciate you joining us today. So, it seems to me like you did a pretty good job of picking the order of importance here. If you'd like, we could just kind of go through this list. Tom Engelhart has a new piece that begins on the topic of your statement number one here about he was just palling around with some lady in New York and she was saying, oh, my God, I hope ISIS doesn't kill us all and whatever. This is really working. The American people are really afraid that ISIS is going to attack and maybe, you know, them, wherever they are, sometime soon. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a real myth. Whatever administration is in power, they are never straight with the American people about why we're going to war. They have to trump up fears that terrorists are going to be bringing suitcase bombs or, who knows, crossing the border bearing Ebola was one version. And what I point out in my first myth is that the ISIS or Islamic State, whatever you want to call them, is not a threat to the American people. It's very much a threat to the people of Iraq and Syria and a very serious issue. But those folks are focused on what's going on over there. They're not about to attack the United States either militarily or through terrorist means. And it's a hype to get people worked up about the war.
Yeah. On the other hand, it seems like along with the beheadings, well, I guess the beheadings are enough. But if the beheadings weren't enough, mightn't they attack the United States in order to provoke the kind of overreaction that they got out of Bush?
I don't think they're capable of doing that. It's a local group. They came out of developments in Syria, particularly, and in Iraq, as a direct result of the U.S.-Iraq war and reactions to that. Sure, is there a danger of an airplane being attacked or some building being bombed? Yes. And we've seen that sporadically by individuals or by people who are taking up the extremist cause. But that's a far cry from saying that these folks are an immediate threat. And in fact, by bombing them, we're giving them an excuse to up the ante and kill more Americans.
Right. Well, and then, I mean, what's really important here is just how successful all the fear-mongering has been, where even TV, cable TV, was surprised at how successful they had been with a week, maybe a week and a half worth of propaganda. The poll came back that 70% or something, am I getting it right? It was some kind of super majority, believed that there are already ISIS sleeper cells all across America ready to rise up and get us.
Yeah, that's right up there with them bringing Ebola across the border from Mexico.
Yeah, it's just amazing.
Yeah, no, I was in northern Iraq. I was in Kirkuk and in Erbil and the areas where ISIS was threatening. And they are a group that have, in some cases, leadership by former Iraqi military men. They are focused on attacking and holding cities in Iraq and in Syria. At the moment, they're not at all focused on trying to attack the United States.
Yeah. All right, now... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that if you trace back its history, this group and terrorist groups in general did not exist in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. He ran a brutal dictatorship, which, among other things, clamped down on any of these extremist type groups. It was only with the U.S. invasion in 2003 and the falling apart of Iraqi society as a result that groups like this formed, and in fact did in around 2006, 2007. So while the U.S. was not, of course, involved in creating ISIS, very much the actions of the U.S. War effort led to its formation and the crisis that we face today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even to the degree that the current leadership of ISIS all became buds, the Baathist generals and the Islamist preachers in Camp Buka prison under American authority there. So,
exactly. Afterwards, when they were fighting the U.S. in the Anbar province, the so-called surge that took place in 2006, 2007, which was hailed as a great victory here, I and many other critics were saying at the time that it's it's not really a victory, and now we've seen what the actual results were.
Yeah, and you could go back and there's a million of these in the whole course of events, but it's just the same damn story every time, where when they attacked Fallujah, I think the first and second time in 2004, they said it was all about getting Zarqawi. They were trying to blame every bit of resistance among the predominantly Sunni-based insurgency on Zarqawi, and he'd never even been to Fallujah before. But they sure turned Fallujah upside down, killed all these people, and made a legend out of him. Which served their purposes and his only too well.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's worth noting that the current war in its relatively calm stage is costing $10 million a day. That's from the Wall Street Journal. $10 million a day for what? For another losing operation in which civilians are going to get killed and eventually Americans are going to die as well.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get to that, the ground troops here. Let me take a note. Hey, let me ask you this real quick before we got to take this break, Reese. This is kind of a theme on this show so far today. I've been talking with Mitchell Prothero and Eric Margulies about this. And I'm interested in your take on just how much intervention has taken place on America's behalf. How much, maybe a better way to put it, how much responsibility do you put on Washington for Saudi and Qatar and Turkey backing the rebels this whole time? How much direct responsibility do you put on America for intervening against Assad the last 3 years, and how much that particular American part of the intervention has led to this?
Well, I don't think that the U.S. is the directing everything that's going on among the Syrian opposition, which is what the Assad regime claims. On the other hand, the U.S., I knew and I reported in Global Post that Saudi Arabia was backing the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. It's called the Nusra Front. And if I knew it, certainly the U.S. government knew it.
And that was what year?
This was 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that the U.S., whether the U.S. encouraged that or simply looked the other way, it doesn't really matter. If the U.S. had really cracked down on Saudi Arabia and Turkey for arming certain kinds of groups, they would have stopped.
Yeah. See, what Prothero said was, hey, go back and look. America classified al-Nusra as al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Syria, terrorist enemies on the State Department official list immediately, which is true. I remember reading it in McClatchy at the time. There was no secret about how bad these guys were, but it seemed like, I guess he was saying that the Americans really didn't want the Saudis to back them, but they kept doing it anyway. But I think I'm more in agreement with you. It sounds like if Obama had been really serious and tried to make these guys stop, they would have.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're sitting in the White House, you know, you've got a plan A, a plan B, a plan C, and so on. They're down to about plan F or G, you know. And what their original plan was to find a moderate rebels, which means pro-U.S. rebels, and arm them and ignore the efforts of Turkey and Saudi Arabia, or cooperate with them only insofar as they back the same forces. But the U.S. was unable to put together a group like that because everybody in Syria opposes U.S. policy in the region. So it wasn't so easy to come up with some proxies.
Right.
Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia and Turkey and others in the region said, well, you're not getting anywhere. We're going to go with our plan B, which is to arm these extremist groups. But we're going to call them moderates.
All right, well, hold it right there. We got to take this break. I want to read your book. We've got an email back and forth about that. It's Reese Ehrlich. He's got this great one at antiwar.com, 10 myths about Obama's latest war in Iraq and Syria. We'll be right back. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Reese Ehrlich. He wrote this one for antiwar.com, 10 myths about Obama's latest war in Iraq and Syria. His website is reeseehrlich.com. That's with a C-H on the end there, Reese Ehrlich. And his latest book, and he's written a lot of them, his latest is Inside Syria, the backstory of their civil war and what the world can expect. And so, Reese, speaking of the moderates and support for jihad all this time, the policy at this point still apparently is, and correct me if I'm off the story here, because I admit I'm a little confused because it's a little confusing, but they say that the policy is to build up a militia of 5,000 men to be trained in Saudi Arabia, like hiring Al Capone to train the police, you say in your article here. And then these 5,000 men are going to take on al-Nusra and the Islamic State, as well as Assad and his friends in Hezbollah, and then they will be the new rulers of the future Syria. And yet somehow I don't see that making sense, and I don't even see how they thought that made sense as a talking point, that that was what their plan was. But so it obviously raises the question of what do you think their plan is? What the hell is going on here? Are they just going ahead and switching back to Assad? Or are they still targeting him for regime change? And they'll use ISIS as a pretext to get their camel nose under the tent flap. And then it's on at some point, regime change Damascus still.
Well, I think what you described in the beginning there is accurate, which is that they claim in a year, mind you, they'll be able to train these new moderate guerrillas, and they're turning it over to the Saudis, whose ideology and whose religious beliefs are actually very close to the very extremists that the U.S. says it wants to fight. The Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia formed the basis for the Al-Qaeda-style groups that of which ISIS is one. So the idea that Saudis are going to train moderates is just a myth. The U.S. has been trying it for roughly 2 years in Jordan. It had U.S., Jordanian, and Israeli intelligence officers trying to vet and train so-called moderates. And it's very interesting. There have been some articles, some interviews with...
I'm sorry to interrupt, Reese, but let me ask you real quick on that point. Are you reporting to me that Israelis there, or do you have sources, footnotes you can?
Oh yeah, that's in my book. It's footnoted. The person, there was a former guerrilla who flipped from the pro-U.S. group to another extremist group, gave an interview, and was published, and I cited it in my book. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, he gives it in such details that it's credible. I believed it. And basically, they were suspicious of everything that these guys wanted. For example, if they grew a long beard, the U.S. was suspicious that they had become fundamentalists, whereas from their standpoint, they were doing it because everybody was doing it, and that's what you do when you're fighting in Syria. And it was actually a very revealing interview about the problems the U.S., Israelis, and Jordanians had in finding moderates, or even some of the groups who accepted weapons, accepted training, went into Syria and flipped over to the other side. There's something like 1,500 rebel groups in Syria right now, and they're constantly changing. One group that's a strong coalition one day is suddenly dissolved and formed into a new coalition the next day, and the U.S. is going to have a heck of a time being able to identify, let alone arm and keep people on its side.
But you're saying there's still no change in the policy. This is really what they're going to continue trying, as laughable as it is on its face.
Yeah, it is. And you mentioned before, what about Assad? Well, objectively, right now, the U.S. is siding with Assad against the extremist rebels. And apparently the U.S., according to press reports, is notifying Assad, as they are the Israelis, when airstrikes are going to take place, and presumably so that the Syrian Air Force stays out of the way. But how long that can last is a big question mark. And I wrote in my article, 10 Myths, that sooner or later, if the U.S. is actually successful and defeats some of these extremist groups, that's going to strengthen Assad. And the U.S. is going to say, well, wait a minute. We're not in this to strengthen Assad. We're going to have to start bombing Assad military targets as well.
Right. They've actually even been saying that from the beginning, before they even started bombing, that we might have to bomb both at the same time to keep it fair. Yeah, like kids exactly. Arguing in the back seat or something. What?
Yeah, with cruise missiles. No, well, it's a crazy policy, and it's going to blow up on the Obama administration.
Yeah. And, you know, judging by just one step removed kind of consequences down the line, I wonder which is worse. Working to continue overthrowing Assad, which would lead to the horrible butchery civil war between all those ethnic and religious minorities and the jihadist types and all that. But on the other hand, America outright, you know, going back to Bill Clinton and George W. Bush days of allying with Assad and objectively Iran against these guys is just going to cause that much worse of problems, especially if it's the Quds force on the ground, Assad's army, and Hezbollah on the ground with America flying the air cover. I mean, what the hell is that for the future of America's relations with all Sunni people and states in the region forever?
Yeah, I think you've put it well, which is the best thing that the U.S. can do is not get involved with either side. And I know that's not popular in Washington, and after all, we're a superpower, so we have to do something. But whatever choice the U.S. makes militarily, it's going to be a disaster for the people of Syria, and they will be able to sort it out with time on their own.
Right. Now, what about ground troops? Because, you know, it's just kind of in the wings and on Fox News all day that, you know, come on, everybody admits, just like with the Syria rebels, it's the same thing with the airstrikes. No one really believes that this is the solution. The solution comes down to sending in the U.S. Marine Corps under the assumptions and the premises of the American Empire. Is there any other way? Who's going to do it? The Turks aren't going to do it. The Iranians aren't going to do it. The Iraqi army can't do it, obviously. Assad can't do it. I mean, maybe if we stopped backing the rebels against him, he could at least take back all of Syria someday. But he's going to root the Islamic State out of Mosul? Nope. So who's going to?
Well, that's exactly the problem. And the U.S. already does have ground troops in both Syria, well, certainly inside Iraq, not necessarily Syria. Those spotters, when I was in northern Iraq, a U.S. diplomat told me that there are the spotters, they're American military troops on the ground directing the airstrikes. There's nobody else capable of doing that. The latest information is that the U.S. is going to be piloting helicopters with the Iraqi army going in to fight in the Sunni areas that ISIS is in control. Now, if you fly helicopters, I suppose that's not literally boots on the ground, but that's, by anybody's definition, that's combat troops. So I think the U.S. is slowly moving in the direction of having more and more active combat troops involved, whether they call them advisors or whatever euphemism they may give. And that's because airstrikes by themselves are not going to win. And there's nobody else on the ground who's capable of taking back the Sunni areas of Iraq. The Peshmerga in northern Iraq, in this Kurdistan region, they probably can take back control of their areas. Although that leads to a whole other set of problems, which I talk about. But other than that, there's certainly nobody in Syria, and neither the Iraqi army nor anyone else is capable of holding and taking back key cities like Mosul. So who's going to do it? U.S. troops.
All right. So now this is kind of a stupid question, but I mean, it's an important thing, but I don't expect you to have a real answer. So it's okay if you don't. But what the hell can we do to stop this thing? This is as bad a slow motion train wreck as the last two times around, certainly as bad as the last time around. And yet it's just all so inevitable. I can hear it in, you know, every, the premise of everything that you say. That just, yeah, here we go again. And what are we going to do?
Well, it's, you know, the train wreck doesn't have to happen. And had the U.S. not invaded Iraq in the first place, we wouldn't be in the situation that we are today. But it's true. Once you're in the middle of the mess, it's very hard to sort it out. The best thing the U.S. can do is stop all military support for anybody, whether it's the Iraqi army, the Kurds, or the Syrian opposition, or Assad for that matter. It will, in the short run, seem like a big crisis, but in the long run, people will sort it out. Remember, there's the reason that we're so concerned about this crisis is because the administration is making a big deal, and the media is making a big deal. There's plenty of very serious crises, including humanitarian crises going on in other parts of the world that we don't hear about and we don't get worked up about because it hasn't been focused on as a key area of oil or other strategic corporate interests.
Right. Well, and what's funny, too, is I heard Pat Buchanan say one time, okay, well, what if China, and I don't know the exact relationship between the Chinese government and the Mongolian government, honestly. But he says, what if the Chinese move into Mongolia and ruthlessly crush all resistance and seize all their mines? What are you going to do about that? You going to have a hydrogen bomb war with China? Or actually, there are some crises in the world that you just, you know, it aren't your responsibility. You can cry serious tears, not even crocodile ones, but you just can't do anything about.
Yeah. Well, I don't think the Chinese are about to invade Mongolia.
Yeah, it was just a hypothetical kind of a thing about something out of reach.
Yeah,
you
they've
know?
Got their good trade relations. That's all they need. And you see, that's what's ironic is that the big bad guys, China, Russia, various European countries, when they want oil or other natural resources, they engage in trade. They establish friendly political relations. But they don't send aircraft carriers and set up military bases, at least certainly not. Well, in the case of China, they don't set it up outside their country. In the case of Russia, in their border areas that they consider vital. But the United States is the only power in the world that has the largest and most of the largest military by a factor of 10 compared to the next group of countries. So. There's absolutely no reason to be spending that kind of money, and the results is what we're seeing, which is even more disasters. You know, there were about 5 million people died in the Congolese civil war. 5 million. And we're talking about 190,000 maybe in Syria, which is a horrible tragedy. But where was the calls to invade Congo and to send troops to fight their allies in Congo? There wasn't, because they decided they couldn't win it. So therefore, we don't hear about it, and it's not a big crisis.
Yep. And it's amazing, isn't it, how the free media, even, you know, not even just quote-unquote, you know, ironically, but the real kind of free media, independent media, whatever, even me, we just kind of stick to their narrative about what's important and not. I've covered Congo a little bit, but mostly only in the context that you just talked about how nobody ever covers it, including me, you know?
Yeah, well, I've actually been in Congo, and I did cover it at the time.
Well, I didn't mean to include you, Reese. I know you do real work.
No, but I understand. You're absolutely right, and there's an agenda in Washington that drives the daily news and that impacts all of us, including folks doing the talk show. So I think what is important is to get out the word that that's not the only possible narrative and that there's other folks doing other things.
Yeah. Well, and I guess, see, mostly my focus is trying to debunk what they're saying. And if they're not talking about Congo, then there's not much to debunk. But the truth is, it's still extremely important, as you're saying. It's one of the worst crises going on in the world of the last decade and plus, yep. Right?
Time to debunk the funk.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, listen, I've already kept you over time, but I thank you very much for your time. I hope people read what you want and what you write. And I want, that's why I was jumping ahead there, I want your book. And again, it's called Inside Syria, the backstory of their civil war and what the world can expect. Reese Ehrlich at reeseehrlich.com. I'm sure you can find that at Amazon as well. We're going to have to
I am on a national book tour. And
I'm sorry. You mentioned that in your email. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, so I'm in the Bay Area for the next couple of weeks. Then I'm going back to New York and Boston and the East Coast in November, and back to Oregon later in November. And for details, you can see reeseerlich.com. My website, it's reeseerlich.com.
Great. Yeah. And then right there at the top, it says speaking and media appearances. So there you go. Come out and help support and get a great book.
Many of your listeners hear this and come to the events, come up and say hi.
Cool. I hope somebody does. I bet you maybe someone will. these things have happened before. All right. Hey, thanks very much, Reese. It's good to talk to you again.
Bye now.
All right, y'all. That's Reese Ehrlich. I mentioned earlier on the show, but not in the context in that interview, but he was in Kurdistan when Mosul fell. He, like I said, he does the real work there reporting these wars. Inside Syria, the backstory of their civil war and what the world can expect. Forward by Noam Chomsky. That's good. ReeseErlich.com for that. And go see him speak at your local bookstore kind of thing coming up in your town soon. All right. And now, listen, I got to switch to Israel-Palestine here real quick. Because, boy, what if I didn't cover this? That would be problematically problematic. And, yes, I'm sorry for blowing the bottom of the hour break again. I just, you know, what am I going to do, man? I'm trying to interview the man. I got these breaks happening. It's terrible. I'm interviewing somebody here. I'm sorry. I suck. I apologize. People get mad. There's a guy in the chat room now who's mad. The other guy's trying to calm him down. Hey, man, it's just part of it. But he's going, no. I'm pissed off, and he's right to be. But what are you going to do? I guess the answer is just listen to the podcast later, and then you spare the interruptions. But I truly am sorry, and I truly am grateful for those of you who stick through the show anyway and listen despite the fact that sometimes these interviews end in the middle of a word. As we go on to a stock Betty Crocker ad that I bet Betty Crocker's not even paying for. Is Betty Crocker even paying for those? So Benjamin Netanyahu says, isn't that, there's something funny coming up, everybody. Benjamin Netanyahu says, that's the beginning of a lot of hilarious things. Benjamin Netanyahu says that criticism of settlements, Israeli settlements, in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, are un-American. Yeah. Accuses President Obama of being anti-peace while calling for ethnic purification. Every time Israel announces, this is Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. News.antiwar.com. You really ought to read everything he writes every day. I mean, the guy is just, he's on top of that for you, okay? Just read news.antiwar.com. Really. Netanyahu, Obama criticisms of settlements un-American, accuses president of anti-peace, of being anti-peace, calls for ethnic purification. Every time Israel announces... Excuse me, pardon me. Every time Israel announces a massive new settlement inside the occupied territories, President Obama warns it is unhelpful, quote unquote, to the peace process. This time, however, even though the comments were materially identical to the last dozen times it's happened, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu claimed to be, quote, baffled. Which is more confused than confused, for those of you keeping score. In comments today, this was written on the 5th, in comments today, Netanyahu went on to declare Obama's criticism of the settlements was un-American, saying that it was part of the White House's plot for ethnic purification of the West Bank. Netanyahu insisted he would never accept any restrictions on where Jews could build settlements and insisted that any position to the contrary is anti-peace and harmful to the peace process. Don't you see? Barack Obama and the Palestinians, why, They're Arab supremacists. And the West Bank is in a state of Jim Crow oppression and segregation, with the poor Israeli Jews unable to live wherever they want, and the evil Klansmen of the Palestinian Authority preventing them from living where they want to. In fact, here, let me follow the link here, because I think there was a better quote I wanted to include about free housing. Americans believe in free housing. Where's the goddamn quote here, man? They should be able to buy homes wherever they want. It's against the American values. It doesn't bode well for peace. There was more in another story I had about it. But anyway, his point being a total and complete lie, an obvious lie, that the Israeli Jews are being denied the right to housing in whatever neighborhood they want to live in. When we're talking about neighborhoods in a foreign country, in occupied territory. Well, I'll try to put this in a way that Americans can understand. If you're a conservative, or even if you're a liberal, and you want tight immigration down there at the border, say just any American, you want tight immigration down there at the border, or even if you don't, but you understand what that argument is about. Civilians from Latin America coming up across the Mexican border and beginning to live here. Many, many Americans are very, very against that. Me, I'm an open borders kind of guy. I don't care about that at all. I don't know what you're talking about. But anyway, what's important is imagine if all of those, say, for example, just Mexican immigrants, Americans call them all Mexicans anyway, whether they're Mexican or not. So just stick to the Mexican immigrants for a minute. What if all the Mexican immigrants that came into Texas and came into Arizona and into California across the border there illegally, what if they built little neighborhoods and then brought the Mexican government with them, brought the Mexican army across the border, took all the best land, and took all the people, white, Hispanic, and otherwise, in those southern states from their land and drove them into the ghettos, drove them onto the worst land, took all the best land, and then built giant walls around the Texans and the Arizonans to prevent them from going on to the new Mexican state territory? You think that might, you know, make you a right-winger on the immigration issue? If every time the Mexican immigrants came here, they brought their army and police, their state with them, expanded their border into our country a little bit more and a little bit more? Oh, all of a sudden I understand. It's not the Palestinians who are the Klansmen preventing the Israeli Jews from living wherever they want. It's the Israelis who are the Jewish supremacists who have occupied, who first of all treat the Arab, Muslim, and Christian citizens of Israel as second and third class citizens in the Jim Crow style, but who literally forbidding Arabs from living wherever they want. From living in exclusively Jewish neighborhoods, even from marrying Jews. And on top of that, they occupy the country next door, Palestine, what's left of it, in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. And all these settlements he's talking about are trespassers, land rustlers, plain and simple, subjugating the innocent people who live there. But he's a liar, so. Netanyahu. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Ain't I always telling y'all what's true? I'm sorry, man, but via a friend on Twitter here, from The Guardian. In the Californian desert, UK and US forces crave a crack at the headcutters. Politicians have ruled out Western boots on the ground in the fight against ISIS, but the Marines must be ready for anything. Yeah, that's right. They fight like they train, and they train like they fight, and they train like that so they can fight like that, because that's their business, is blasting folks with weapons. We blasted some folks. And I've been saying since long before the declaration of the caliphate, as some of you regular listeners know, that they're going back. They're sending the Marines to go back. There's no other way around it. There's nobody else can do the job other than sit back and wait and do nothing, in which case the problem will resolve itself, because the Islamic State is surrounded by enemies, and the people who they rule have every reason to hate them and want to destroy them, and probably do ultimately have the capability to do so if they are not the vanguard in the fight against all the rest of their enemies. But do you think the American Empire, their coalition of the killing? I'm sorry, I try not to do stupid sayings and stuff. You think the Americans can sit back and not have a war? Let the situation resolve itself? Ah, they're sending the Marines. Take out your map, everybody. The government in Baghdad and its army and all the Shiite militias from there to Basra, to the southeast to there on the road to Kuwait there. All those guys, they're capable of holding their territory. I think you can count on that. But they're not capable of taking back the Sunni parts of Iraq. Even with Iranian help. Even with American air power flying cover for them. I don't think they can. Then you got the Kurds in the north. As he was saying, they can probably hold on to their own territory, which I think he was implying. They've now taken Kirkuk, and he's reasonably confident they can hold on to it. Although, sounds like the reason he didn't go off onto that tangent was because it's a whole other subject of whether there's going to be a war with ISIS for Kirkuk between the Kurds and ISIS. That's probably coming, and I guess the Americans will probably help the Kurds hold it. But they already, you know, they hold it now. It's not a matter of taking it. But can they take Mosul and Tikrit, the Kurdish Peshmerga? Nah. Nope. And then you got the Turks, who, they won't do a thing about it. They're happy to watch the Islamic State and the Kurds fight about it, as you heard from Mitchell Prothero earlier. They're sure as hell not going to invade and sack Mosul and Tikrit and Fallujah and drive the Islamic State out of power there. And Raqqa. And the other parts of Syria they control as well. They're not going to do that. Assad may be able to take back all of Syria someday if we would just stop backing his enemies for a minute. But we can't, because that's what the Israelis want. And that's what the Saudis want. And that's what the Qataris want. That's what the Turks want. Have mercy. So Assad, well, he's got about a quarter or a third of the country that he can hold. Call it Basharistan. The eastern portion of Syria is pretty much gone. Maybe he could take it back with, you know, Russian, Iranian, and Hezbollah help if America and its allies were not on the other side. Yeah, the terrorist side. For a little while. But invade Iraq and drive them out of Mosul and Tikrit and Fallujah? No. No. The Egyptians can't do it. The Saudis can't do it. So you've gone counterclockwise with me all the way around the map there. From the east to the north to the west to the south. There's nobody that can invade and dislodge them. And under the premise of the American Empire, it's got to be done. We're not going to wait around. They're going to do it. They're going to send in the Marines. And I'm sorry, I don't know if there are like people in the Marines that you can help go AWOL before it's too late. Or, you know, whatever you need to do to participate in this thing. I set up a nonprofit organization called People Who Don't Want to See Young Kids Lied Into the Marine Corps in the Name of a College Education Die for Nothing in Sunnistan. Something like that. But it's coming. It's just a little logical game I'm playing, and so it's very much possible that there are other factors that I just haven't thought of. Oh, I left out the Jordanians, but the Jordanians, they can hold their border, but no, they also cannot invade the Islamic State and outright win a war and a surrender from it, anything like that. No way. They can keep them out of Jordan, according to Eric Margulies, so I'll take that. You should believe that, too. If he says that they're badasses, I'll buy it. But they can't invade. They can only hold their own line. Anyway. So, yeah, I'm sorry to say, I don't know. If only I had $1 zillion, you know what I would do? I would finance a gigantic anti-war group. And I would hire people who have never worked for the CIA to vet my moderates. But I would try my very best to make a coalition of libertarians, code pinkers, paleo conservatives, and decent regular people, including other rich people if possible, to create a new anti-imperialist league, to have a real fight about this and put an end to this. But I ain't nobody, and I ain't got no bank account. I mean, I have one, but there ain't any money in it. And so, there ain't nothing I can do except call the score for you and tell you the bad news before it, you know, goes down. Well, while it goes down, and sometimes I do a little bit of predicting, too. But, yeah. War Without End. That was a Metallica song back before they were the worst band in all of world history. They actually used to rock back before that. So yeah, that's the name of it. And you know, I don't know. I saw a thing that was supposed to be an honest political commercial, and it was a military industrial complex executive saying, "Yeah, don't vote because that way I get to make all this money being an arms industrialist." And like, okay, I get your gimmick, but what the hell's voting got to do with that? Whoa. What has voting got to do with that? When was there a battle between a Republican and a Democrat, and one or the other of them was avowedly anti-military industrial complex welfare for bomb and plane and submarine manufacturers and abolishing the world empire? Oh, I guess that would have been the last time Ron Paul ran for re-election to Congress in 2010. Would have been the last time that happened. Now look at the Democrats now. All the leaders and all the front runners, and never mind the Republicans, right? I mean, when Jeb comes, it's going to be hydrogen bombs all around. Who knows what more damage the Bushes could do? The Democrats are the closest thing to the doves we got. Barack Obama, who's bombed 7 countries. That's right, Afghanistan, where he escalated a giant surge and prolonged that war for years and years, sent 100,000 guys there, got more people killed in the year 2010 than Bush got killed in the entire occupation of Afghanistan up to that point. Don't forget that. Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, Syria, Iraq. Barack Obama, the mad bomber. He's the closest thing to a dove you got. He is the most restrained chief executive America's had in a long time or will have for a long time. It's either Hillary or Jeb next, right? And Hillary sounds just like Leon Panetta here. This thing is not going away ever. It's a long-term struggle. The superpower versus a more or less a stateless militia of less than 30,000 guys with AKs. Isn't that funny? How they gotta fight forever, but they just can't ever win. I wonder if Hillary had a little conversation with her people about what number should we put out there. You know, people kind of got mad at John McCain when he said stay for 50 years, stay for 100 years. That was what it was, 100 years. Bush, I had the clip somewhere of Bush saying 100? Geez, I don't know. How about 50? Like in Korea. But he was thinking a peacetime occupation. That's what he was talking about. You know, like winning and being welcomed there forever after the fight against the bad guys is over or whatever. Hillary Clinton, oh yeah, no, we're staying forever, but yeah, we're going to be fighting the whole time. Hillary, who never wanted to leave. Hillary, who's happy to race out in front, saying this is Obama's fault for leaving. Obama's fault for not backing the rebels enough, for pulling out of Iraq. She wanted to keep a base in Kurdistan all along. Now we have to rebuild one? Oh, but did you hear? She'll be the first female president. Isn't that really special?